Hi there. My name's Ryan Bernstein, and this is 50 States of Mind, a cross-country journey to all 50 states to talk to mayors, governors, and voters on both sides of the aisle to figure out what's really going on in the United States. I'll be honest, when I started this trip, I wasn't optimistic about the state of our country. But after visiting our neighborhoods, towns, and communities, I've been given an exciting education that has allowed me to listen, challenge my preconceived notions, and taught me something new. Are you ready? Let's go. This is the 50 States of Mind Season 1 finale. We're really excited. We're going to be coming back next season with more states, more interviews, and more shattering of preconceived notions. But to cap off this season, we've done pretty much every continent except for Antarctica. So it was time to find someone who had ventured to the darkest, most mysterious continent. 50 States of Mind is sponsored by Gen M. You can check out more about how you can get an apprentice for your business in a link in the bio. And we're part of the Demcast Podcast Network, which we are so excited to be a part of. There are some really amazing podcasts out there. Two Broads Talking Politics, one of my all-time favorites, recently on one of their episodes, and they're just bringing the most fascinating people from presidential candidates to authors to thought leaders, and it's definitely worth a listen if you're hankering for something new while 50 States of Mind is away. So without further ado, we are going to talk about Antarctica. Okay, here we are, 50 States of Mind, no stopping us now, and we have a very, very, very special guest with us today. What's your name, young man?
Hello, my name is Nacho Juarez, and I'm from Spain. I'm studying here at Oxford, starting my DPhil in penguins.
Penguins. I didn't know that was a major I could have, because I would have done it.
Actually, the DPhil would be DPhil in zoology. I wish it was. I was a doctor in penguins when I came out of this degree. No, unfortunately not. In my research group, our main aim is penguin conservation. That is true. And we run a citizen science project. So to keep the project running, we need to have to be permanently doing outreach. And for these kind of things, for example, my supervisor made up his job title. That is, he's Tom Hart, penguinologist. And he appears with that title every time he's interviewed. And it has caught on. I've heard of at least 4 other people, penguin scientists, that have started calling themselves penguinologists because it's just such a cool name.
So my question for you is, I feel like everybody loves penguins.
Yeah, apparently.
Do they live up to the sky-high expectations that we hold of them?
That is such a great question. Yes, they are amazing. When you go to Antarctica, they are as silly. No, they're not as silly as they look. Poor things. But they look as silly as you want them to look. You see them and you see them waddling. And they I think the most amazing thing about penguins, about seeing them in their own environment, is that they don't give up nothing about you. Completely nothing. They don't even look at you. You're just part of the landscape. They don't care about you. So they go and do their stuff as they would do with, even if you were not there. You need to be careful. You need to respect like a 5-meter distance from them, but they don't. So if you just stay still, they will just go past you without even looking at you. And I think that is the most amazing thing. And not only they pass by you, but they do their silly stuff while they pass next to you. And it is just hilarious when you see them, going up or down a slope and they're waddling through the snow. And suddenly they're just fed up of walking and they just go on their bellies and toboggan up or down the hill. And it is just amazing. And you're just there like, I can't believe I'm in a natural history documentary at the moment. It's really, really amazing. So yes, they do live to their expectations. And they look so nice and so happy, despite they might not be. Probably half of them are super stressed with the breeding season, but they do look amazing. There is only one downside. They do have one downside that we don't see in documentaries, and is it that they smell? I must admit, they smell. The good thing is that in Antarctica, as it is so cold, smells don't travel very far. But so in smallish colonies, you know, it's not uncomfortable. But in super big colonies, suddenly it's like, woof, somebody has been eating fish around here. So it smells like the worst of the sea.
Okay. Are they cuddly? Do people cuddle penguins?
You cannot cuddle
a penguin. You cannot cuddle a penguin.
You cannot cuddle a penguin, first, because for welfare reasons. So, mm-hmm. for example, for us, the scientists, we do need to fill in endless forms of for animal welfare before we do anything to a penguin, even standing next to them.
Mm-hmm.
So we, for example, we do have the permit to go beyond this 5-meter limit that normal people, you know, lay people would have, or that sounds terrible, lay people, sorry. Tourists, for example.
Non-scientists. Yeah.
We lay people sounded terrible, sorry. I've been reading.
I'll accept that. That's fine. I'm a lay person in the penguin.
No, department. Oh, come on. No, it's, I've been reading, fantasy books lately. I'm sorry. Anyway. So we can go beyond that limit, but even touching them first is you would need a permit for that. But even for a permit, you would need to be the touching of them should be motivated. Like you would need to do it for a scientific reason. Even though we do have the permit, we cannot do it just because they look, you know,
cute.
Okay.
But
even if you would be able to, they would bite you. Okay. They do. When you come close to them, they do snap at you with their bills, and their bills have serrated bits that I don't think most seabirds have this. They have serrated bits so the fish doesn't escape their bill when they catch them. So it's not. I've been caught by other types of seabirds. I've done other seabird work, and it is not. It is not pleasant.
Oh wow. Okay. Well, that's. I'm not going to try to cuddle a penguin anytime soon. So tell me, I think you're probably the only guest on the podcast that I've had or will have that has been to Antarctica. Can you give me a layout of how you got down there and sort of the Antarctica state of mind?
So to put you in context, there is one thing that I need to say to your audience. Because this is something that I myself didn't realize before I started doing research in Antarctica or being interested in doing research in Antarctica. And the first thing is that Antarctica is huge. Antarctica is twice the size of Australia.
Mm.
So it's way bigger than the US. So I think I've been looking at the figures. The US is 9 million square kilometers. Antarctica is 14 million square kilometers. It just the numbers just go off the charts. It's freaking huge. The thing is that as it is at the bottom of the maps and you don't normally pay attention to it, you don't really have a sense of scale of how big it is. Also because it's like dislodged or because of the projection, but it's actually very 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 big. And it is all covered in ice and snow. And it's all glaciers and rocks and sea and seals and penguins and seabirds. Whales? Did I say whales? Lots of whales. It's amazing. It's a truly, truly, truly amazing place. And it is probably the incarnation of the word stark. Like it's bare. It is a fantastic thing to be there, to go there, because on one hand, it is completely stark, but on the other, it is so absolutely full of life, because you can see penguins all the time, whales all the time, seals very often, seabirds all the time. It is amazing. It is really, really, truly amazing how a place that to us, it reminds us of probably, I don't know, the tops of the tallest mountains of the Rockies or the Alps. Because it's literally mountains coming out of the water with glaciers on top, what you see from the boat. How this place can be so full of life. Because when you think of similar places, like the top of the Rockies, I mean, you're lucky if you see an eagle or mm-hmm. a vulture in one day walking in the Rockies. Hopefully, well, you could be lucky and see a bear. You could be very unlucky and the bear sees you. But anyway, that kind of thing, or a deer or whatever. But there, it is constant. It is, you are being splashed with life at every, you know, at every corner. And to go back, sorry, I digress a lot. But I wanted to give people a feel or a taste of what it is to go there. And how do you get there? So we do research mainly in the Antarctic Peninsula. So if you see a map of Antarctica, you see that Antarctica is more or less like an elephant's head.
Oh wow!
It looks like if you look at Antarctica from the South Pole, you would see that it looks like an elephant head. So the Antarctic Peninsula is this bit of land that goes up towards Argentina. That would be the trunk of that elephant's head. That is,
oh wow,
this bit here. So we go to do our research. What we do is we fly to the southernmost city in Argentina. That is called Ushuaia. A lovely place, by the way. And then we take a boat that takes us from there through the Drake Passage, that is the worst sea in the world, to the Antarctic Peninsula in roughly 2 days.
When you say the worst sea in the world, as in danger or...?
As in, choppiness. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's never dangerous, because if it gets too dangerous, you just don't go. Mm-hmm. So it is just unpleasant.
And I'm guessing it's not like a Royal Caribbean cruise line.
Almost. So
really?
Yeah. So we're going, our project is a very small project. And it is basically funded by donations and a couple of UK NGOs and many, but a lot of donations actually. And so we have a very low budget, and there is this company called Quark Expeditions that they do tour cruises down to this piece to the Antarctic Peninsula. So they let us go on their cruise ships to do our science while they do our tourist, and we are the scientists in residence for the tour cruise. And basically what my supervisor has done is to engineer back a system to study penguins, provided that we have this type of transport available to us. And so what we do is every time the guests disembark to see a penguin colony, what we do is we take samples and take our measurements. But what we mainly do is we deploy cameras in the Antarctic. So what we do is we set up these like camera traps that you would use, or trail cameras, I think you call them in the US. Mm-hmm. And we use them we program them to be used as security cameras. So these cameras would take one photo every hour, and they would, they basically, by the end, when we come back the following year, we change the SD cards, and we have basically a time-lapse video of the year of the penguins. Then we use volunteers, and this is where the citizen science side of the project comes in. We have a webpage, penguinwatch.org, that you can come and help us annotate the penguins, and it's for a fraction of them. So 10% of the images, volunteers annotate them and tell us where the penguins are. Then we take that information, we use that to teach an algorithm, and the algorithm goes through 100% of the images to tell us what is a penguin within each image. That is what our project is about. And then we use that to assess what is the conservation and the colony status of all of these colonies that we survey thanks to this cruise line.
You mentioned that there are, you know, U.S. bases. You mentioned that there are multiple countries that have sort of settled, have an outpost down there. What's the sort of geographic, political makeup of Antarctica right now?
So the geopolitical situation in Antarctica at the moment is that Antarctica is at a standby. So I think this dates back to the International Geological or Geographical Year of 1958. So a lot of that were, you know, during the Cold War, the US against Russia, and whoever was in between was, you know, you could not be really in between. But what happened is that there was a lot of tension, and people were starting to see Antarctica as a place for dispute, because nobody was there, so who was going to take over that territory, either the US side or the USSR side. And what happened is that there was, I don't know how politically motivated was this, but there was an International Geological Year, or Geographical Year, I forgot completely, sorry, that basically were lots of countries, both aligned with the USSR and the US, decided to take measurements in all over Antarctica at the same time and share the data. And share the data, I think it was magnetic field data, if I don't remember wrong. And this collaboration proved to the governments that it was more worthy having Antarctica as a neutral area than to actually have people fighting for it. So since then, lots of things have happened. But basically, what happens today is that below parallel 60, Antarctica and the Antarctic Sea is a no-take zone. So it belongs to nobody, although there are claims. Lots of countries claim parts of Antarctica. But it is nobody's until 2040, when this treaty is to be renewed, if everybody agrees. And by everybody, I mean everybody that is in the Antarctic Treaty. And that is everybody that has at least a summer base in Antarctica. So you cannot have a voice in the Antarctic Treaty, this treaty that keeps Antarctica free from exploitation or even exploration for oil or gold or any type of prospection or any extraction. It cannot be done under the Antarctic Treaty, at least until 2040. And it belongs to nobody. So only the people that have... one bit of history that I missed is that neither Russia, or in its time the USSR, nor the US have a claim to Antarctica. And they both did this to support this treaty. So other third countries could have claims to Antarctica, but not these two, as a way to take Antarctica out of the Cold War, which I think it was a very nice move, at least for the penguins. So you can only have a say in the Antarctic Treaty if you have bases there. So there is 40 countries, I think, that have bases there, at least. No, there are 40 permanent bases and 30 summer bases, 30 additional summer bases, of which three of these bases are American. There's McMurdo Base, that is the biggest one, that have almost 1,000 people in summer. That is the biggest base in all of Antarctica. And it is, for you to picture it, it's below New Zealand. Then there is the Amundsen Scott base, that it is right at the South Pole. And then there is the Palmer Station, that is in the Antarctic Peninsula, the trunk of the elephant that we've said before, just below Argentina. And all of these bases can only be used for research. They cannot be used for economical profit.
Mm-hmm. So there's no oil drilling?
There cannot be any oil drilling. Of course, I'm sure there is somebody, you know, claiming to do... I'm sure there will be someone saying, oh, I'm doing these geological cuts, but they would probably be looking for where rich metals could be, mm-hmm. you know. I'm sure.
So
more than one country.
Actual topographical makeup of Antarctica is not just snow and ice. It's land.
Yeah. So Antarctica is a continent. Mm-hmm. That is also a very good common misconception. Very good point, because this is a very common misconception. So everybody's more familiarized with the Arctic, and not so much with the Antarctic, because especially, you know, the world is North Hemisphere centered and the Arctic is closer to us. But for you to have an idea, the Antarctica is the absolute opposite of the Arctic. So the Arctic is one pole in which there is a lot of sea surrounded by land. Mm-hmm. Antarctica is the opposite. It's a continent right on the pole, and it is land just covered in a lot of ice, surrounded by sea. This makes the conditions completely, completely different. I was going to sidetrack, but I won't. What happens? Antarctica is actually a proper continent with mountain ranges and everything, and it is, the Transantarctic mountain range is quite high. Don't ask me heights now. I think it's near the 4,000 meters. So it's in the, I think it's around the same height as the Alps. But, and actually I think the mean average height of the Antarctic soil, so of where the land is, it is very, very high. It's 3,000 meters. So I think that's 9,000 feet. Because Antarctica is mostly a plateau. It's a huge, huge, huge plateau with an average height of, 9,000 feet. So it is a continent, just that it is covered in ice. And all of its valleys are now covered in ice. All of its mountains are now covered in ice. But once, it was a tropical continent, like thousands of millions, well, maybe not thousands, but hundreds of millions of years ago. And you still find tropical fossils, like palm tree fossils, when you study the geology of it.
So, do people live in Antarctica year-round? Is anyone...
Only the people in these research stations. That is the only people that live there permanently.
And are they there year-round, or do they kind of...
Yeah, so, for example, in the British Antarctic Survey, if you are hired by them to stay over winter, the contracts are 18 months. So you stay one Antarctic summer, one Antarctic winter, and one Antarctic summer again. Which for me would be a bit too much, but there is people that are perfectly suited for that, and they love it. And there is people that actually repeat and they chain contracts. They stop one and they hire another, or maybe they change base, but they stay in Antarctica for more than 1 year, which for me would be too much.
Okay, so
I go summer only.
I'm interested in what day-to-day life is like in Antarctica from your experience, and what it would be like for someone who stayed for an 18-month contract. What would you do day-to-day?
Work, watch films. When I've had the chance to talk to these people that actually live there over winter, what they tell me is that they have huge hard drives full of films, all sorts of films, and e-books. All sorts of ebooks to pass the time, because the Antarctic winter is dark. So in Antarctica, especially if you go below the Antarctic Circle, so below 67 degrees of latitude, you really have 6 months of light and 6 months of darkness. There is 6 months in which you don't stop seeing the sun in the sky, and there is 6 months in which you wish you saw at least a glare on the horizon. So those 6 months must be very, very, very hard, and they entertain themselves as best as they can. But they still need to be going out working to take, for example, to talk about one of the American bases, in the South Pole base, in the Amundsen Scott base, there is one super, super, super cool experiment that is called Ice Cube. So this is a physics experiment that what they do is that they're trying to track neutrinos. I don't know if you've heard what neutrinos are. So neutrinos are a type of subatomic particle that is traveling through space, and that it is so light and so subtle that it... I don't know how many neutrinos are going around, through the Earth every second, but there is tons of neutrinos going through the Earth every second, and as they are so subtle, so small, and so light, they don't interact with anything. So they have built this massive cube of ice in the ice to try to detect neutrinos down there in Antarctica, in the American base, and they've done it there so they wouldn't have interaction with any other sort of electrical equipment that could somehow alter the readings.
Mm. Okay, so...
So one person might go out in the morning, take the readings, do their 8-hour job, and then...
Outside the entire time?
No. So this is a lab in Antarctica. No.
Okay.
There is people that do go outside to take other type of measurements, like to go to several weather stations that could be around the base, for example. That's typical.
But what's the longest you could be outside?
What's the longest? Yeah. You know, there is a saying in Scotland that says that there is no such thing as bad weather. There is only bad clothing. So, but I think that in winter, when temperatures in the Antarctic plateau can go down to, I'm going to say this in Celsius, sorry for the American.
I'll translate it.
So this is something like, I think it can go to minus 60 without much complication. That must be something like minus 120 in Fahrenheit. I'm just guessing.
Okay, wait. It's negative 76 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's still pretty cold.
It's very cold.
And that's without wind chill. With wind chill, yeah, it would be like negative 700 degrees.
I don't want to imagine.
I've lived in Chicago, and I think that's cold. I think Antarctica might be the only thing that actually trumps that. Okay, so have you heard horror stories about people losing electricity? Have you lost electricity? Are there like ghosts down there? What's the scariest thing that's ever happened?
There were enough horror stories during the discovery of Antarctica. Horror stories, I mean, I'm not saying ghost stories, but real horror stories in which, for example, you know, the Shackleton expedition that had to overwinter in Antarctica because their boat was caught in the ice in the Weddell Sea. And they basically had to stay over winter because they couldn't go anywhere. The winter caught them and literally caught them. The boat was clasped in ice until the ice was too strong and reduced the boat to shatters. And they had to, you don't know the story about Shackleton, it's amazing. If you don't know the story of Shackleton,
Can you give me just the cliff notes?
It's amazing. So the amazing thing is that they survived. And they survived. Actually, I want to Google now the Shackleton's advertising for his expedition. It is the best fiction thing that someone has written in reality. The advertisement, you can Google it, is amazing. It says, "Men wanted for hazardous journey, small wages, bitter cold, long months of complete darkness, constant danger, safe return doubtful, honor and recognition in case of success. Ernest Shackleton, 4 Burlington Street."
So that's what he put out to get people to join him.
He was apparently a great, great man, and especially a great, great leader. And that is how he managed to get everybody alive from an Antarctic winter in which your boat is completely crushed to shards in the middle of the Weddell Sea, absolutely surrounded by ice, and the nearest help was probably, I don't know, 3,000 kilometers and a sea away.
So what do you mean crushed to shards? What do you mean?
That the ice grew and it just collapsed the boat into the wood, basically. And they managed to salvage enough to make a sleigh. So they used the dogs. They repurposed the boat to serve as a sleigh and used the dogs to take them to shore. So then they repurposed the sleigh to serve as a boat so they could take them to one island, and from there they went to another island that was inhabited to ask for help. So to show you on a map, they were basically caught like somewhere around here in the middle of the nowhere, and they slayed their way up to here, so, or somewhere around here, and then they crossed on a boat from here to those islands because this was the closest. Oh no, sorry, it was Elephant Island. So they went to here, and then he himself with a handful of their men made another boat and went to Elephant Island. That is where the whaling station, the closest humans were, that was a whaling station. That's Shackleton's trip. Yeah, amazing.
Is there a movie about this?
I don't think so, actually. There are several books. Like, actually, he himself wrote a book about this.
I think I have so much work to do, but I think I have to read the book.
it was very, very, very good. And anyway, so after this is a real life horror story. And after all of these horror stories, we are super, super cautious when we go to Antarctica. And we just don't, we don't risk it at all if we can. If you know, if you're in the middle of the Drake Passage and the storm catches you, well, that's unlucky. But today, with all the tools that we have, that's unnecessary. Unless the tools fail, of course. Right. But the satellites and the forecasts fail. But if you have to wait for one more day to cross the Drake Passage because it's just terrible, you just wait.
Right. And the boats aren't made of wood.
No. Anymore. Thank you
so
very much.
You can't make it into a sleigh, but you also probably would be crushed by the ice easily.
Yes, exactly.
Some of the benefits of progress, I guess.
And,
Wow. I'm feeling really claustrophobic right now.
It must have been terrible. But there is, I mean, if you want, I can also give you, to take this bitter taste of your mouth, I can also give you a sweet story from Antarctica.
Please.
And it is the story of Toby the Pig.
I already like it. It's already making me feel good.
There's even a children's book about this.
I'm going to eat a piece of chocolate while you tell me this.
Oh, please. So,
that's my palate.
You know, there is horror stories, but there is also fantastic success stories that people normally don't hear about. And it is all of the stories of all of these explorers that have done their job uneventfully. You know, you go to Antarctica, you take your measurements, you make your maps, you go back. And you tell your government, hey, this is what I found. And your government goes like, hey, congratulations. And namely, the one that did this, maybe not best, but in the most style, was Charcot. Charcot was one of the French explorers in this, it's called the Age of Heroic Discoveries in Antarctica. Mm-hmm. Antarctica was the last frontier when all of the world had been discovered already. Discovered. Such a Eurocentric thing, but you understand what I mean. Like, mm-hmm. had been mapped. Let's say mapped. I think it's better. But Antarctica hadn't, because it was just so hostile. So these guys were doing this, and the one that did it in most style, for my taste, was Charcot, the French explorer. He managed to be sponsored by Mumm Champagne. You've probably heard about the brand. The brand is still active mm-hmm. today. And so he had champagne in his trip to Antarctica. And he was... Oh, he was an amazing guy. So, you know what his boat was named? His boat was named after the toy boat that he played with when he was a kid in his parents' house.
Aww.
And the boat name was the Pourquoi Pas, the Why Not, which I think for a name for a discovery boat is just, it's just amazing. It cannot be done better, the Pourquoi Pas. So, he went on the Pourquoi Pas to Antarctica. And he was just a great leader. So he really took care in raising the moods of the expedition, of all of the crew members, and to feed them well. Okay, so to raise the moods, one of the things that he did is that the year previous to the expedition, he collected one newspaper for every day of the year that the expedition on the following year would take place. And he took them down to Antarctica and he would hand them the newspaper from that day but the previous year to the crew, so they would have something new to talk about, despite it happened a year ago. But I think it's just such a good idea.
So I love that
they have a notion of time passing.
Mm-hmm.
So and it's not like day after day of cold and bitter ice biting your bones. It's just, I think it's just amazing. And apparently they were very, 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 very well fed. And this is where we come back to Toby the Pig. So they were so... Normally, when what you want a pig in the boat for is to have basically fresh meat.
Mm-hmm.
But these crew members were so well fed that nobody thought of slaughtering the pig. Because they had grown accustomed to the pig, and they took him as the pet of the expedition. And he made Toby the Pig made it alive back from Antarctica two times in two different Charcot expeditions. That tells you how well, you know, fed the expedition was, basically, and how well, you know, provisioned the expedition was. And not only that, but the pig died in Antarctica because, you know, death. And And the pig was buried. It was not even eaten, not even then. It was buried there by the crews, by the crew in an, I don't remember the name of the island. I think it was Useful Island. I don't remember. And apparently the bones have been found, I think. So it is true. It is true. And that's a success story of how, you know, missions to Antarctica should, or expeditions to Antarctica should go. They should go smoothly. There is no need to risk anything. And if something goes bad, just turn around and come back to safety.
I can't even imagine the feeling of camaraderie, feeling of tribe that comes with going on a Antarctic expedition. Do you feel that with your crew when you got on there?
Yes. I mean, you are work focused, but at the same time, it's a bit diluted because we go on a cruise with tourists that we need to, you know.
It's not like you're on an old-time exploring ship.
Yeah.
Yes.
So it does, I mean, if something goes wrong, you are at best 2 days away from a hospital, which is, you're never that far away from a doctor because there's always a doctor in the boat, and we've been trained into what we could call, you know, into far from help.
Mm-hmm.
First aid or second aid, some people call it. We are trained in that, and we always have a doctor with us in the boat. But there is no, you don't have the feeling that you're, well, you know what? Sometimes you do, because so sometimes you don't go where the cruise goes.
Mm-hmm.
And then you are in the middle, you take the rig or the raft, the Zodiac.
Mm-hmm.
And you go to a penguin colony that the guests are not going, and that nobody ever goes. And you wonder, well, when was it the last time, if ever, that someone has been here? Like, my supervisor and other penguinologists are discovering penguin colonies every year. So they're going to places that nobody ever has been there, or if that person has been there, has not left written record of it. So, yeah, sometimes you do have that sense of discovery. It's not what these guys must have had 100 years from now ago. But sometimes you do, and it feels very, very nice. And even if it's not just that, just thinking that how few people are as lucky as you are to be watching that absolutely dramatic landscape, because I tell you, it's dramatic. Have you been to the Norwegian fjords?
I'm actually going to Norway in a few weeks.
Oh, lucky man. So it's like that, but covered in ice and penguins.
I'm going to have to go. Okay, I have two more questions for you, re-Antarctica. Actually, I have three questions. Is it Antarctica or is it Antarctica? Like, what's the proper pronunciation?
I am not a native English speaker, so I will leave that to you. I would say Antarctica, but...
See, like, American accent, it's like Antarctica, but some people say Antarctica. Like, there's a C in it.
You can...
There's some flexibility.
I would go for Antarctica, but I think that's because I'm Spanish and we say Antarctica.
Antarctica.
because that C there is just too difficult to pronounce for us, so we just ignore it. But maybe in English, just as you say Arctic, you can say Antarctic.
Arctic.
But it feels like you're going on a rocky road.
Yeah, it's the little speed bump in the word. Okay, so last two questions. So when I was on an improv team in college, there was like one rule. It was like, you guys can't date each other because it's like too close quarters and like it would get awkward. Do romances ever blossom in the field?
Hasn't happened to me, but apparently yes. Apparently, even so, in winter bases, it does happen apparently quite often.
That's what I was thinking.
Because humanity.
Yeah.
Because that's how we are. And if you have... Bueno, I don't know if you've been to a summer camp.
I have.
But I'm a scout, and in my scout group, we call this the summer camp effect. And it's the people that you don't find appealing the first day. Don't worry, you will find them appealing on the last one. And that's why so many romances, I think, happen in close communities.
So if someone was not having good luck in the dating game, maybe they felt like they weren't getting the proper attention, maybe consider a trip to Antarctica.
A long one.
Yeah, a long in the winter.
Oh, yeah.
Close quarters. And the last question is about penguins. Is it true, the story about the pebble and the penguin? Do they actually do that? Have you ever seen the movie The Pebble and the Penguin?
I haven't seen the movie of The Pebble and the Penguin, but...
But, you know, you need to get the pebble as part of the mating ritual to the penguin that yes. you're into. Is
so
this true?
This is absolutely true. So, not for all penguin species, but at least for the ones I study, yes. Basically, what happens is that you as a penguin, don't want to leave your... You don't want to lay your egg on the ground. First, because the ground might be covered in snow and the egg cannot go cold.
Right.
Birds' eggs, if they go cold, even if it is for a very short span of time, they can die. So they must be maintained at a high and constant temperature throughout the whole development of the egg. Otherwise, the embryo inside can just die and it's irreversible. Mm-hmm. If your egg goes too cold, even if it is... For a minute, that's it. That's done. You have lost 1 year of your breeding opportunities. Tough luck. So penguins don't lay their eggs on the ground. Instead, what they do is that they build a nest. And the only thing that you can build a nest there, let's remember, a continent with no vegetation, almost, apart from some grasses that grow on the north faces of some of the northernmost places of the continent and the subantarctic islands. Apart from that, the only thing that you can build a nest with is with pebbles. Literally like, yeah, plum-sized pebbles, more or less, irregular, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do is that they build these nests, like more or less like the size of a cot. And so what they do is that they raise their egg from the ground. So if it snows and the snow melts, the melting water, let's say this literally freezing water, 0 degrees water, can go below the egg without touching it, while the father, while the parent is on top, and the egg will still be warm and will not basically literally freeze to death. This is true for the egg and for the chick, because the chick before the molt is very, very, very vulnerable to water. But actually, sorry to digress a bit, but this is actually one of the reasons why climate change is threatening penguins so much, because now temperatures are rising and what used to be snow is now rain. And penguin chicks are used to being snowed on. You know, they have this type of fluff, but snow, as it is, that fluff is so isolating, it doesn't melt. And when they move, they wriggle a bit and the snow falls off. But if it is rain, the rain soaks in and the penguin dies of hypothermia. Of going, basically, literally the penguin chicks die of cold if it rains. Despite the rain is warmer than the snow, which is counterintuitive. Anyway, what was I saying this? So yes, one part of the ritual for the mating, for penguins mating, is offering stones to the partner as a way of saying, well, apart from many other things, as a way of saying, I can provide for my partner, and look how good I am at finding stones. Be this finding them in the surrounding areas or stealing these from other nests because it's quicker.
Have you ever been so busy that you were like, I wish I had an intern? I've been there. Between grad school and driving to all 50 states? Well, thanks to Gen M, now you can. Gen M offers you an apprentice for 90 days to help with your business, no matter if it's a startup or a podcast. You can search for apprentices based on skills, languages, and countries, and swipe through countless options to find the perfect person to help you grow your business. I'm such a fan of my apprentice that I'm offering everyone who signs up $10 off for clicking the link in the bio of the episode. So what are you waiting for? Start looking for a teammate today. Okay, and now I need to dive into this climate change situation. So what effect is climate change having on Antarctica as a whole, or specific species like penguins?
So penguins are suffering quite a bit from climate change all through the range, not just the Antarctic penguins. There's also penguins outside of Antarctica. There's many in the subantarctic islands, but also in Africa. There's African penguins. There's penguins in Australia, New Zealand, and South America. Even as far up, as far north as Ecuador, the Galapagos penguins. Mm. So there's in total 18 species of penguins, and of those, 12 are threatened in some way or another, and either by fisheries or by a warming climate or by both. So, actually, the fisheries are also threatening them because of climate change, because the ice is melting, so it's easier to reach into Antarctica for boats. So there is places where you can fish now that you couldn't fish 20 years ago.
Because the ice is just gone.
So, yeah. Because the ice is just retreating more and more every year. Anyway, so that is... And the decline is not being super, super steep, but it is being constant. So every year you can see more and more colonies having, you know, bad numbers. Bad numbers, bad breeding numbers. Breeding performance is just not as good as it should be. On a long-lived bird like a penguin that can live 15 years, something like that, that is fine because the effect is kind of muffled. It is buffered. Mm-hmm. But at some point, this will catch up and we will have steep declines in penguin populations, probably in most of the species. It's happening. It's happening. And if we don't do something in the next 10, 12 years, the situation is going to be pretty dire for them if this doesn't revert or slow down in some way.
And I know this is out of your area of expertise, but what can we do?
What can we do to stop climate change? I'm going to sound very boring, but it's the same that you are told all the time. That is, take a plane only if you need to. Try to favor other types of transport, like train or road. Try to not buy things that you don't need, because these things are transported, especially things that you're going to only use once, single-use plastics that then also cause other type of pollution. But all of these things are manufactured in, you know, cheap countries that produce cheap and quick, like China or generally Southeast Asia. And not only that, but there are so many things that need to go, I don't know, from China to Bangladesh, Bangladesh to China, China, Bangladesh, then to the US. And then that trash, once you have used it, it goes to put back into Indonesia. So the amount of carbon that you're emitting just by using something a single time, like, for example, a straw, it's just mind-blowing. The cost of you to use a straw. Let's go through this. If a straw is plastic, so plastic is mostly taken out from Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, one of these oil-producing countries. The oil is refined there, then it is taken to one of these factories in Southeast Asia. Then it is taken to you, the consumer, in Europe and the US. And then you use it once for, I don't know, how long can a milkshake last? Half an hour. You put it in the bin.
So that's not long for you. We're like 5 minutes, right?
We're having a friendly conversation. Yeah, and yeah. We're making this milkshake last because we're enjoying the conversation. Yeah, okay. So half an hour, and then you put it in the bin, and, you know, the first world countries, the West, we don't recycle most of our trash. We take it to other countries to recycle it for us, if they do recycle it. Sometimes we just take it to other countries just to put it there. We pay to other countries to do this. Actually, China has just refused to do this anymore, or has put limits to it, and that's caused some trouble to us. Anyway, so now that trash has been to put back into another country to cross the globe again, to be put somewhere there indefinitely. So there is something here that doesn't make sense. It is better to not use things that you don't really need, not to fuel this machine of use. It's better to close the circle and use reusable straws, or call me crazy, not use a straw. It's really not necessary.
Am I the only one that doesn't like using a straw?
I do like using straws, but I have quit it.
Yeah.
But sometimes you're not even asked. They just give it to you in the milkshake.
I will say, I mean, milkshakes, it might be easier with a straw, but having worked in restaurants, I always get yelled at when they're like, why did you give them a straw? I'm like, because I'm trying to save the earth, bitch. Slash, I'm not a very good server. Like,
I think that's the only good reply. I'm proud of your reply.
Well, I'm trying to decide right now, like, if it would just be disrespectful to a state to even talk about it. Like, is this just the Antarctica State of Mind episode?
I don't know. But yeah, I mean, basically, it's just, and same for clothes. How it is just unnecessary to buy the amount of clothes that we buy, and I include myself there. So, or to transport them from the other end of the world so they can cost less. So I'm trying to buy less clothes, better quality, because when I buy Primark, like I'm wearing now, you know, this comes from Bangladesh. Let me just check Primark, Bangladesh. Yes, spot on. This has probably even used child labor, which is fantastic.
They don't use child labor?
Yeah, they probably do.
Oh.
I mean, they will say that they don't, but they hire one. Or they might not even know as a company.
That's the brand.
So anyway, basically buying less clothes.
Buying less, literally.
Just buying less in general.
Buying less, buying only the things that you need. Try to buy local, because if you buy something that is super fantastic, like an avocado, but this avocado, you know, now it's not the season in your hemisphere. So you're buying an avocado from New Zealand, or I don't know, or Peru, or Chile, that they produce a lot of these. Because you want an avocado in winter, it might not have an economic cost, because we have made transport such an efficient thing that the economical cost is not much, but the ecological cost is much more. And I tell you something, without ecology, you don't have economy. Well, that's that. I think let's not go that far into that.
Yeah, it's basically just realizing that we can't do whatever we want all the time. Freedom has its limits. But it really, whose responsibility is it to put in place these rules? Like,
government.
You think that's who should do it?
Of course, because what? Who do you want to do this? The consumer has to push towards it by choosing, because shopping and buying is a political act. When enough people decide not to buy something that is, you know, wrapped in plastic or whatever, then the company says, okay, let's change this. Okay, so you change the world, you change your community, that's politics, by shopping. Great. Or if you can do that, although it is difficult. So, and even if you push towards that direction, the ones that can actually enforce that decision is actually the businesses and the governments. And one business is not going to do this on its own, because the sole purpose of a business is to earn money.
Yeah.
It is the only thing that businesses exist for, and it's perfectly legitimate. It is, because you don't open a shoe shop just to make shoes for people because that makes you happy. No, you open a shoe shop because you want to earn money doing something that you like. But the main objective is earning money, because you need to pay for your rent. So unless all of the CEOs of all of the companies suddenly become super environmentally aware and they make a push to agree, all of them, to do the same thing at the same time and not to be put in a comparative disadvantage, which is very unlikely to happen and hasn't very rarely happened before, this is the responsibility of the governments to put a law so all of the businesses in the same branch are put with the same hampers that would save, that would maybe affect the economy a little bit,
mm-hmm.
but they would not crash any business, any single business, and they would save the ecology. I think it's governments. it can only, this can only be done through law, in my point of view. Because one single company cannot go and say, go rogue and go like, well, you know what? We're not using any more plastics. So our price to compensate for that, our price is going to go up by 20%. What's going to happen to that company? It's going to crash.
Yeah, everyone's going to. Yeah, it's just realizing that we are guilty too, because I'm always like, what's the cheapest thing I can buy? Like, I don't, and not thinking about the environmental impact, because I think a lot of people feel like, all right, I'm just one person. If I do this, like, it's not going to make that much effect, and I'm spending more money that I work hard for, and I don't make that much in the first place. Yeah.
Yeah, and, but I think, yeah, you are absolutely right. And we all think like that. Myself, the first one. The thing is, you need to hold your horses a bit and, for example, think, do I really need this? Am I really going to use this? How long am I going to use this for? That is the thing. Buying things is not bad because you need things. The bad thing is buying things that you don't need. Or things that are unnecessary. I don't know. There is this. I don't know. This goes beyond climate change, but it is a bit more the way our Western society is built, and we. I mean, sometimes I do too, to relieve ourselves from stress or just to make us feel better. We buy things. This is not something that we do maybe often, but it's like, oh, you know what? I really like that T-shirt or that dress or that whatever. I would, you know, you buying makes you feel good, and this is because of an inherent flaw of our design. It is because we are being told all the time that if you don't have the latest, name it, iPhones. Brands, whatever, you are going to be left out. This is what marketing is about. The marketing is about you creating a need that you don't have.
Yes.
So you spend money or realizing that because if you really have a need, you don't need an advert for it. Or steer your needs toward a certain brand. This is what advertising is for. But most of the profit comes from you buying things that you don't actually need or making you feel that you don't belong to a place if you don't have X, Y, and Z. Mm-hmm. I think that causes other problems. But I think we're going into the politics side of this, and I don't think... Anyway.
Yeah, that's... it's tough to look in the mirror and see how much you are a part of it, and not you specifically.
No, of course.
Everybody, and that's what's so tricky about it. And it is, it can be disheartening to see a brand, you're like, this is 100% like renewable, whatever. But you also know that that's part of some sort of marketing ploy. Like, they know that they're going to make a profit off of that as well. It's all very cynical. So I guess we should just all move to Antarctica.
No, please. Leave Antarctica alone.
Yeah. Actually, we need one pure place left. So, okay. I guess my final question is, what is the Antarctic state of mind, and what can we learn from Antarctica?
What do you exactly mean by the state of mind? Like, what does Antarctica transmit to you, or what do we want Antarctica to transmit to your audience? What can I transmit from Antarctica to your audience?
Like, what's it like to live there? What are the common qualities of people that have spent time down there? What do you learn in your day-to-day?
Okay, so I think the Antarctica state of mind, given... I think the Antarctica state of mind that I have found there, talking to both tourists and researchers, I think it's a state of constant curiosity, because there are even parts of it that are uncharted, and even the parts that are uncharted are changing all the time, and you are expecting, and you're right to expect, a new thing around every corner. So I think the thing that unites everybody that visits Antarctica is curiosity. Curiosity and a wish for discovery, for encountering something new, for learning something new, for seeing something new. I think that would be the Antarctic state of mind.
I love that. We could all use a little bit of that in our day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Well, I didn't anticipate this becoming a special episode. I knew it was going to be a special episode, but I didn't know it was going to be a special episode. I think it's best to leave this alone and not pollute Antarctica with talking about a state. It's this stands alone, and it makes me really want to come and visit this place and see what it's like, but obviously in a nice cruise ship and not in a wooden boat that gets caught in the caught in the ice over the winter. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Oh, one more question. What's the difference between, like, do you see, are cultures visible there? Like, is an American military base in Antarctica different than a...
I don't visit bases. Mm-hmm. So, no. One nice thing about the boat, though, is that there's a lot of nationalities in there.
Mm-hmm.
And seeing the interactions between them, that's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
This is something that I have only, like, I am lucky enough to live here in Oxford, that is such a multicultural city, and you have nationalities interacting all the time.
Yeah.
Right? Today, I have sat for lunch with 5 people, and we were from 4 different continents. So, where do you get that normally? It's amazing.
Yeah.
It's amazing. And this is something that I encountered on the cruises there. And I think it's just so refreshing to find people and to find yourself realizing how similar you are to somebody coming from the opposite side of the globe. It's just very, very refreshing and very, I don't know, it brings down mental barriers and prejudices that you have.
That's exactly what this is all about. And that's why I think people who are educated are people who have had the opportunity to meet people from a lot of different cultures and have had a lot of different opportunities. And I think that education doesn't always mean that you know more than other people.
No.
But it's, I think those who are educated need to take the privilege of having met a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds and sort of spread the good news that actually we're all pretty...
Much the same.
Yeah. And that's
and
that goes for everyone. It goes for someone who isn't educated. It goes for someone who, you know, is a doctor from Zimbabwe or a...
I mean, we all suffer the same way. If you lose a child, you're going to cry the same if you're from Nigeria as if you are from Kansas City, Missouri. you're just going to have the same grief. And that's for location, and for education is the same thing. Education is something that you are given. You know, being ignorant is not something bad on its own, and it's not something despicable on its own, because, you know, ignorance is the default that we're all born with. It's not something that, oh man, you knew, you grew up knowing how to do this and that. No. You were given it because of your background allowed it, or because, you know, you were lucky enough to have that education, and we should all the time consider that. So you should never look over the shoulder to someone that doesn't have your level of education. Really, never, because it's you don't deserve it.
And the amazing thing is, I mean, here we are. We're both students at Oxford. I literally didn't know that Antarctica was land until today. So just it's the holes you have in your education. I think one of the biggest things about education is realizing all the things you don't know and probably will never know. And that's why having conversations like this is really valuable and enlightening. So
also, your time is on Earth is limited, and you can only direct your learning towards certain and certain place. So there will be things that you know and things that you don't, but those things someone else will have learned them. And so for every person, you will always have something to learn from them and something to teach them. So
that's why we need each other.
Yeah, exactly. And that is fine.
Yeah.
And it is fine to not know things, and it is fine to teach them, and it is fine to learn from them.
Yeah, thank you for teaching me, and I wish you all the best in your next expedition to Antarctica.
Oh yes, I will. It will be fantastic.
I can't wait. Thanks for coming on, and see you soon.
No problem, my pleasure.
This is 50 States of Mind. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you to producer Mike Layer, our sponsor Jen M, and the Demcast Podcast Network. We're so glad to be a part of you. The title song, Travelers, is used with permission from the band Bright Moments. If you want to reach out, you can follow us on Twitter at 50 States Pod, on Instagram at 50 States of Mind, or you can go to our website, 50statesofmind.org. That's 50 for all of those handles. Looking forward to hearing from you next season. Thank you so much for listening. It's been amazing. And if you have a chance, leave a review. At this moment, we're not quite at 50, but two of you leaving a review would make a huge difference. See you next time.